Outside beatnik circles, there wasn't a lot of exposure to Buddhism back in the 1950s and 60s, but writer and University of Washington professor emeritus Charles Johnson discovered a book on yoga and meditation on his mom's bookshelf when he was a teenager, and it sparked in Johnson an interest. He's now a Buddhist. Johnson is a novelist, screenwriter, and essayist. His latest book is Taming the Ox, a collection of short stories and essays. He sat down with Marcy Silman and explained how his work as a writer intersects with his religious beliefs.
My creative work and my spiritual life and spiritual practice are very much intertwined. If you look at the history of philosophy, you see, for example, a lot of religious thinkers and so forth emerging in the Middle Ages, for example, medieval philosophy. So, and also Buddhism is non-dualistic. This is what distinguishes it from every other world religion. It is non-dualistic and non-competitive. And according to Paul Tillich, the great Christian theologian, that makes it one of the most competitive religions in the world, the very fact that it isn't competitive.
How so?
Yeah, well, because for a Buddhist, you can also embrace wisdom that comes from other traditions and religions. Thich Nhat Hanh has a portrait of Jesus on his meditation stand, for example. You know, the word philosophy simply means the love of wisdom. Safrasaini is love, and I won't give you etymology, but it means love of wisdom. And Buddhism is all the Buddha Dharma is all about wisdom as well. But one of the things Buddhists recognize is that wisdom can be found anywhere. It is not the property of the East or the West. Hmm. So you can find wisdom, you know, just under your feet.
Charles Johnson is my guest. He's a University of Washington professor emeritus, and he has a new collection of stories, essays, and related writing, which is in its own section. It's called Taming the Ox. One of the threads through all your work is questions of race and identity and, yes, and the American culture. A specific essay addresses what Buddhism can offer to African Americans who, I'm assuming, are still a minority of Buddhists, but perhaps I'm wrong. I don't know every
yes.
Buddhist, but I'm suspecting that I'm correct at this point. So how, first of all, for your decades that you've been a practicing Buddhist, what's it like to be maybe the only black person in a room? Does that, do you notice that? Do you feel it?
And of course you notice it. But it isn't something that you make a big deal about. There is a growing number of black Americans who have embraced one form or another of the Buddha Dharma. You know, people saw Tina Turner's movie and maybe they were surprised to see her chanting Nyam-myo Renge Kyo, which is from the Nichiren Buddhism tradition, Soka Gakkai. Many black Americans are in Soka Gakkai more than any of the other branches of Buddhism because they actually proselytize. They say, if you're a member, you should get your friends to come in, right? And that's very un-Buddhist, actually, for most traditions. But in the cities, they have like 15% black and Hispanic membership, the large urban areas, Chicago, Detroit, you know, New York. So they've done a very good job of outreach. But the article that you're referring to is called Why Buddhism for Black America Now. That was a talk I gave at a Buddhist ethics seminar where I met David Loy, who I'd always wanted to meet because I love his book, Non-Duality. But the title could have just as easily been Why Buddhism for America Now. And I think we're living in very dangerous times. I've never been a very materialistic person. I just am not like that. And I've not particularly been much of a hedonistic person either. What works for me is work and discipline and personal discipline. I think we're at a point in the early 21st century where people are questioning materialism. We are bombarded every day by 3,000 product messages.
3,000?
Yes, every day. Every day. We are. You open up a magazine, you open, turn on television, you see billboards, we are, it's there even in your subconscious, even if you're not consciously aware of it. And I think we have to make decisions about what we feel is the good life and what our goals should be in life and not have those dictated by a very materialistic and sometimes decadent society.
You know, it's interesting. As you're talking, I'm thinking about something completely different, except for that it's about spirituality, and it's about the changing nature of America. I was speaking to an auxiliary bishop from the Seattle Archdiocese, and he's Mexican-born, and his job is to do outreach to parishes to talk about the changing nature of the Catholic parishes in the Seattle area, the Pacific Northwest, because we have an increasing Hispanic population, both American-born and foreign-born, and that changes the nature. So there is a need for spirituality in people who come to new places and are rootless. But it seems also that what you're saying is that America has a need for some sort of spiritual center that isn't.
I think so. I mean, I think
that we don't have.
Yeah, I think a lot of young people get very disenchanted with the idea that all they're supposed to do is work to have and get things and, you know, material things, and there's no turning inward to look at one's own mind and how it operates, for example. Now, one of the things that we've been told, and I think it's happened already, is that by 2042 or something like that, we have the browning of America, whereby minorities will outnumber white Americans for the first time. That is causing a big demographic shift, a sea change. It's already affecting the school curriculums in California, right? K through 12. Because the education that we gave kids, really up until quite recently, was very Eurocentric. It was very much for white kids. And then you had the period of integration, beginning of Brown versus Board of Education. And so a lot of black students came into schools where the curriculum was all white. I never was introduced, K through 12, to a black author. The first book I found by a black author was, again, in my mother's library. It was Richard Wright's Black Boy. And I looked at it and I said, what is this? How come my teachers never told me about Richard Wright's Black Boy? It felt like contraband, like something I wasn't supposed to read. And then, of course, I went to college in 66. I went to college, and it was around 68 that Black Studies began. I participated in my school's formation of a Black Studies program. And so we got more people of color into the curriculum in the liberal arts and humanities. But that's an ongoing challenge. We still have to figure out how to juggle so much of this in our schools. And that applies to media as well.
What role does spirituality play in furthering the browning of America?
I'll tell you.
Yeah.
There's a line I love. It's in my other book, Turning the Wheel, but I'm quoting somebody, I don't remember his name, but he said this: whatever it is, it's you. Whatever it is you're interacting with, whatever it is you're engaged with, whoever it is you're talking to, it's you. Because Buddhism does not divide the world up into self and other that way. So that's the motto: whatever it is, it's you.
Charles Johnson is with me. His new collection of stories and essays is called Taming the Ox. What do you personally seek through your spiritual practice?
I sat before I came over here, just briefly. You know, I enjoy sitting. But one of the things you learn, of course, is that you don't have to stay on the pillow all the time to be in a meditative state. You should be in that state all day long. Right? Mindful state. But it's the formal sitting on a Zafua pillow is just renewing for me. It's like recharging my battery. I meditate so that I'm, well, basically, to put it this way, so that I can go back home. I can go back to the values I embrace, nonviolence and love and the bodhisattva vow of trying to help other sentient beings overcome, you know, suffering and experience happiness, because during the day we get all kinds of static coming at us. We get emails and we get, you know, stuff diverting us away from what is our spiritual practice. So, but we can do our spiritual practice anywhere, whether we're washing the dishes, you know, or teaching a class or writing a story.
You talk about coming home. You and I are speaking 2 weeks after a Ferguson, Missouri grand jury decided not to indict the officer that killed the unarmed teenager, Michael Brown. Subsequently, we heard about a 12-year-old boy shot. We heard about the grand jury decision in New York not to indict a police officer who choked to death a man.
Eric Garner.
So anger has been ignited again. Anger is always there.
Yes.
Senses of injustice are always there. But right now, that is in the streets around us as we speak. So how do you use mindfulness? How do you use a spiritual practice in the context of this kind of...
Well, in the new book, Taming the Ox, Buddhist Stories and Reflections on Politics, Race, Culture, and Spiritual Practice, there's an essay. I think it's the last one in the section of essays called Every 28 Hours, The Case of Trayvon Martin. And I wrote that for Tricycle for their blog right after Zimmerman got off. And what I talk about is the fact that I have been stopped. My son has been stopped by the police on occasion in New York and here in Seattle. Always a case of mistaken identity. But as a black American male, you live with that. We have to walk across a minefield where people have planted mines and IEDs for us to step on and blow ourselves up. And you kind of learn that. If you don't learn that in childhood, you're going to get blown up. You have to know where the minefields are, and that means you have to listen to your black elders who have crossed that minefield to a certain extent, and they can tell you where the dangers are, right? Now, with those cases that we're talking about, you naturally feel anger. You feel anger. But in 2007, I took formal Buddhist vows as a lay Buddhist in Upasaka. 10 of vows, and one of the 10 is do not get angry. And that one's one, that's one you have to wrestle with. You can take that energy of anger and transform it into constructive action. So you don't have to lose control of your mind and emotions. But you can look at anger and you can transform it into something that is going to reduce suffering.
Thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you for having me.